from theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. My guests today are Greg Flo Dawson, Adam Toon, and David Matisse of the Cutting Edge Live Remix Trio Keys and Crates. Based out of Toronto, this three-piece is revolutionizing the way electronic music is offered up in the live setting, scooping samples, adding melodies, and playing with the rhythm on the fly while on stage. The band recently went into the studio to capture their essence in record form. The Blackout EP will be released in early November and features a surprising array of Moombahtone, dubstep, and juke. We'll be hearing sneak peeks from the album today, including this opening number, Love to Love You, with some help from the incomparable Donna Summer. Today's episode is brought to you by DJ Tech, offering a wide array of tools for live production, studio programming, and everything in between. They've got state-of-the-art mixers, USB turntables, amplifiers, CDJs, and all sorts of accessories. On the web at djtechpro.com. Let's get to the interview with Keys and Crates. So me personally, I like a good origin story. I gotta know what planet my superheroes are from or what type of radioactive insect bit them. The whole nine yards. So David Matisse, let's start with you. From all your side projects and gigs, I can tell you're a very schooled musician. When did your training begin? Were you convinced from an early age that you were gonna be a professional piano player or musician and you know, just you knew it straight out?
Well, no, I mean, actually when I first started playing piano, I was 4 years old, and for the first half of my life, I thought I was going to be a break dancer, to tell you the truth. And
so did I.
And once I saw that wasn't really panning out, I only had maybe three or four power moves I could do. I think it was in high school, my older brother, for a gift, our mom gave him a Korg Trinity as a gift because he finished grade 8 piano. And once he had that, I kind of got to kind of sneak on it when he wasn't on it. And from there, I mean, it was like my first real experience kind of making, you know, working with a keyboard that could, you know, make beats. And I think I was maybe, you know, 15 or 16 at the time. And that's when I kind of knew this was the path I wanted to kind of take. And from there, it's just been, you know, jumping on whatever kind of project that I was really excited about. And Keys and Crates kind of was one of those things where, you know, at a point, it was just something that seemed really amazing to kind of begin, and it's kind of gone on from there.
Do you read then? Can you read charts, or are you completely self-taught?
I'd like to think once upon a time I could read charts. It's been a long time, but I've definitely schooled in that. I've got my classical training, so, you know, it's like having your papers. I've got them, but, you know, don't put a piece of paper in front of me today and expect me to be able to play it, I guess. Everything we do now is pretty much by ear or by vibe. So I've had to throw out a lot of that training. I feel like a lot of that classical training is almost like you learn it and then you almost have to throw it out and start again from the beginning.
Sure. And Toon, have you always been a hip-hop head, or has your career been unfolding one gig at a time as it often does for drummers?
Yeah, I used to play in rock bands back in high school, and it kind of, I guess, there wasn't many hip-hop bands when I was in high school, so. And actually, I started playing the steel drum, which is kind of weird.
Really?
Yeah, in high school.
We're learning stuff too here.
So I was in a steel drum band when in high school, and then I kind of got out behind the kit and started banging away at that. But yeah, I don't know. I was more into like pop music until I went to college, and I started rooming with a kind of a pothead, hip-hop head, and kind of got me into that, and that's kind of at the beginning for me of the hip-hop stuff.
Still, I just have to say, there is some inside dirt that we won't get too deep on, but Adam Toon has rapped before.
Oh, that is very inside information.
Nobody will ever hear it, but he has rapped before, and we've heard it. I just wanted to put that out there. That's all I want. I'm just going to leave you with that.
And there's a reason why no one's heard it, right?
Yeah, go ahead, answer that, Greg. Absolutely. I also sing in the track.
Oh, I didn't say there was a song. Now you're telling about the song.
Oh shit! So Greg, Flo, you've been a major figure in Canadian turntablism through your time with the A-Team DJs. Can you give our audience the sort of Reader's Digest version of how you even got your hands on a set of decks?
It just started when I was really young, and I think I was listening to rap from like a really young age, like 9 years old. When I think about back to that, it's kind of crazy, but I just remember watching rap videos and being more intrigued with what the DJ was doing, and being more intrigued with like the beats and the scratches and the samples on the records necessarily than what the rappers were actually doing. So I always kind of wanted to do it and figure out. I didn't even really know what was being done. I just knew that I wanted to get turntables and kind of do what was being done on TV and, you know, in the rap videos, and kind of mess around and scratch records. And my parents thought I was insane. And I just went ahead and did it anyways, and that's kind of how I got into it. Like it was completely sort of, you know, innocent, intrinsic kind of interest. You know, I didn't think I was going to ever really DJ in front of people. And then somebody tells you you're good, and then you think you can DJ in front of people, I guess. You know.
And I imagine you were always at the whim of maybe the MCs you were working with, or just sort of what set you were in. Was there any concept that you had of, well, I can spin other people's stuff and I can mix it in such a way that it's my own? But did the concept of production ever present itself to you, or was it just you were so deep into this hip-hop world and that's what you do, is, you know, you get other people's tracks on your decks and you spin them and mix them for the MC or whatever project you're in, and that's what you do?
Well, I never really worked with rappers, to be honest with you. I mean, I did a little bit like on mixtapes later on, but it was really like I kind of went straight into competitive DJing, like battle DJing, at a pretty like young age.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much 2 years after I got turntables, I was already doing DJ battles. So yeah, it was kind of production. Actually, never really like, it's not that it didn't enter my mind, but I never really got into production seriously until I started working with these guys. Like I was like dabbling, but it was more like just about being a DJ. So I got into production like pretty late, like, you know, like few years ago kind of thing. But I the competitive DJing thing was what I went into. So like the heavy scratching, beat juggling, and DMCs and ITFs, that was kind of my thing for years. And then I transitioned out of it into being like a club DJ, got really bored, and then, you know, wanted to do something new and sort of starting working with these guys, which kind of amalgamates live performance and production and, you know, jamming and everything. So
and before we get to that combination of the three of your strengths at this time, this is a few years ago now, can you try your best to tell me what Canadian audiences are listening to or were listening to or expecting out of an electronic music show at this time? I know 10 years ago when I was in Canada, it was all about drum and bass, and then in the mid-2000s came deadmau5 and the advent of electro house. Is there any sort of good generalization for where the sound is today, or is it just the age of information where everyone is listening to all sorts of stuff?
I think a little bit of that, and, you know, obviously it's kind of a dubstep world now, you know, like,
absolutely.
I think everybody's kind of listening to dubstep in Toronto, and Canada is really no exception. But I don't know, man, it just seems like it's becoming very split up and niche, you know, like the guys that like dubstep 2 years ago are now like the hipsters are over it, and they're like into the really sort of heavy beat stuff or minimal techno stuff or a cross between, and they're kind of snobbing off dubstep. And then, but the young kids that really want to party like dubstep and electro house, but then it's complicated because they also like, you know, like Pretty Lights, which is to me kind of similar but very different music at the same time. So it's kind of a weird whirlwind of what's going on now overall. I definitely think the US though is more sort of ahead in terms of what's going on electronically than Canada, probably because you just guys that just have a bigger population. You have more festivals and you just have more sort of regional scenes, you know?
That's actually sort of backwards from what it used to be. Canada used to be far ahead of the U.S. in terms of electronic music.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is certainly the population's got to be a factor.
Well, I mean, I think, like the drum and bass stuff was, I remember it was so big in the early, late 90s, early 2000s, right? Like Toronto was kind of like a hub. All the UK guys were coming over. And even there was like a lot of big Toronto guys and whatnot. But I don't know. I think the U.S. is definitely sort of caught up, and it's got its own scene. Like, I mean, there's the whole U.S. kind of festival market and the Jamtronica market and the dubstep guys in the U.S. that aren't necessarily super massive overseas, but they're gods in the U.S., right? And that sort
sure.
of seems to me like a newer thing over the past 5-6 years. I don't know.
Lucifer, courtesy of Mr. Max Romeo, from Keys and Crates' Blackout EP. We followed that up with the KNK remix of OK Go's All Is Not Lost. Let's get back to the Keys and Crates story. David Matisse, did you all know each other from the Toronto scene and just bumping into each other and it happened organically, or was there a concept from the outset of what KNK was supposed to be?
Toon and I, we've known each other since college. We've kind of been playing in the same kind of funk and soul bands. I mean, he's kind of been really the first kind of drummer and the last drummer I've worked with. So, you know, his strengths and his weaknesses, I know pretty well.
Sorry, I don't know where it's going with this, but it's actually supposed to get interesting.
I was trying to dig you, but I decided not to. At the beginning, yeah, Toon and myself, we knew each other, and we were in a soul funk band, and you know, we were playing quite a lot throughout Toronto, you know, just doing gigs in that circuit. And actually, we met Flo, I guess, 4 years ago now? 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, it's like
yeah.
Four.
And we had a mutual friend who, you know, put the word out. At the time that we met, Flo was really interested in doing something with bands. He'd been playing, you know, his sets, and I think he was very interested in kind of exploring what would happen if he'd work with musicians. And on the other side of the fence, I was very, you know, bored with the musician band scene, and I was really interested in working with DJs. So our mutual friend Abby, he kind of told us, you know, that we should get in touch with each other, and we kind of did, and kind of started talking from there. And then Flo and I started jamming for a little bit, and then I told Toon what we were up to, and he was like, "This sounds dope," and we kind of started all kind of rehearsing together for a little while. And it took us a while to even figure out what we were doing. It was a good 6 months of kind of just sitting in a rehearsal room and trying to just you know, the language between musicians and DJs was very, very, you know, broken at the beginning, and just trying to figure out how to make even a track or what we were even doing took a while. So there was quite a learning curve at the beginning to even figure out what we were even trying to do other than just jam. We really didn't want to be like a drummer DJ act or just some type of act that goes up and just, you know, spangs our instruments and there's real no rhyme or reason to it. So it took a while to figure it out, but that's kind of how it happened.
So let's break down this live remix concept, which is at the crux of Keys and Crates. First of all, the basics. How do you choose what song to attack? And is there a sort of formula for how it percolates through the band? Does it maybe start with flow and then you add the melodies and then tune complements the drums? Or is it an ad hoc arrangement that's unique to each individual track? Each track that you go after is its own story altogether.
Typically, before, it started with a sample, and then we kind of build around the sample. And if we could, you know, sort of build an energetic track that we liked that grooved around the sample, being like Tune could rock a dope original drum groove to it, and Matisse could do some interesting things melodically or synth wise with it, and we could make this different track and we'd rock with that. But I come in like, I kind of, so when I bring in samples, I don't know, I just kind of look for open stuff that sounds interesting or fun or, you know, recognizable, or, you know, that we could make kind of like a live party joint out of. But there really isn't too much for like rhyme or reason to it. It's more just like, does it sound like we could freak it, and would it fit into our set of what we're doing?
In the live setting, is there a regimented flow from one song to the next? Do you have a very choreographed set list, or is there a lot of room in your sound to move freely between this or that depending on crowd or setting or what have you?
There's a little bit of leeway. Most of it's like, I would say probably 80% of it is probably scripted, maybe a bit higher. We generally come in with, generally when we're rehearsing, we rehearse weeks or on end and come up with these little mini sets of tracks that we kind of put together. And then we can kind of have the freedom to kind of move those around. But I think usually, it's just recently we've started kind of free-flowing some things when we see the crowds starting to vibe on a part. We'll extend it or switch tracks like right on the spot. You know, Flo will just drop a different track and, you know, that maybe wasn't expected to come in.
What sort of communication then takes place on stage between you? Because I imagine there are a lot of moving parts, you know, between doing these remixes on the fly and then the technology itself and all of that. I imagine you're constantly, I don't know if it's a secret or something, if there's some sort of telepathy that you've developed that governments might want to know about. But if you can pull back the curtain a little bit, that would be nice.
Well, it's funny you said it, because last night I was just thinking about that on stage, and I was thinking that the three of us now have got to the point where we don't really have to say anything to each other on the stage. We've gotten to the point where it is almost like telepathic, where it's just, we're just, I know when Flo's in a good mood or when Tune's not, or I can tell when Tune's, you know, in his pocket or when not, or if I mess up, I know they're going to look at me in a certain way. It's just a look, like a little wink maybe, or a smile or a grin, or it's so subtle. I don't even think the audience knows it, but we know our sound so intricately that if one of us even messes up even a small bit, the other two are just boom, look at, you know, him. And we usually joke around about it, you know, because it's usually sounds that, you know, the general audience wouldn't be able to hear, but we see it. And then also, you know, a lot of times when we are kind of free, when we're freestyling it on the stage, a lot of it comes down to, well, how long are we going to stay on this jam, and when are we going to go back to the part that's scripted? So that's when we all kind of have to look at each other, and it's just a bit of a nod or a stare, or maybe, you know, someone put we'll kind of put one hand up in the air and kind of do a let's go one more time with the loop. And it's all just a little bit of hand gestures and nods, and there isn't really a lot of talking. You know, we don't really have a lot of freedom to do that, so you know, we've gotten pretty good with the signals, I would think, now.
Yeah, I also think, like, I think we started to develop, like, I can hear within Flo's scratching of when he's going to drop a sample. Like, there's certain licks that kind of come right before he drops it that, I don't know, it's probably just from time him doing that, but sure, it just happens. Or if I'm doing a build-up, it's not necessarily, it may go 8 bars, it may go 16, but there comes a point where I do certain things that kind of lets everybody know that we're going into the main groove. So I think it's about playing with each other. Big, huge pause there.
Let It Rain from the Blackout EP, coming soon from Keys and Crates.
Flo, I wanna go back to a little bit of what we were talking about with trends in electronic music. I wonder if you guys are sort of poised on the cusp of this collapse between indie music and electronica and hip-hop, because it's not like you're going after the easily remixable, which is a dance tune, a hot dance tune, or the big hip-hop album, whoever's hot right now. You're going for a lot of more obscure things, obscure in the sense of what it is you're doing in the live electronic realm, like Florence and the Machine or OK Go. Is this a purposeful thing on your part to go after music that maybe isn't necessarily that heavily remixed, or is it just stuff that sort of moves you and you want to do something with it, or you hear a sample in it and say, you know, I got this, I know what to do?
Yeah, it's more about the latter. Like we're not at all trying to be obscure or like indie in any way. Like, you know, we remix like a lot of obvious stuff. Like, you know, we remixed Jay-Z and Dr. Dre in our set. You know, we're working on an Otis remix right now. Whether it works out or not, it works out. But I think for us, and what we were talking about last night, is the most important thing that we're kind of trying to develop is our sound that you could kind of transfer to any sample. A sound as producers, because it really is live production. You know, we're just mm-hmm. doing it all completely live off the floor. But, you know, now that we have this EP coming out and we've actually gone and translated that production into the studio, so we've translated sort of our sound into a studio setting, you know, it's becoming more about our sound and crafting out a sound more than the sample that we're actually using. Like, yeah, we like try and pick clever samples, you know, of stuff that people kind of recognize, but maybe it's not so obvious, but sometimes it's really obvious. And, you know, the Florence and the Machine was something we did just because we kind of just got the idea to do it. And the OK Go thing we did because it was an official remix for OK Go. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're always trying to, I guess, demonstrate what we can do as producers, because ideally, like, you know, we would love one day to possibly work with artists. I mean, it's not our first priority goal, but, you know, we would like to be viewed as, you know, the same way I think, like I was talking about last night, how, you know, we view like Neptunes and like Timberland, and now viewing guys like Pretty Lights, you know, who are like, they don't even work with artists, but they're like the modern Timberlands, because they're like these producers that are on sort of like, you know, the stage, and everybody's looking at them, and they have like a particular sound that they've crafted that's like, you know, that track is like a Pretty Lights track, or, you know, just the way you used to say like 8 years ago, that's like a Timberland track, like all the way, that's 100% Timberland, that down to like, that's a Timberland snare, or like, you know what I mean? Like, so I think we're kind of trying to develop our own sound within that, so that when you hear our sound, whether you come to a Keys and Crates show and it's like, you know, you're partying to it, or you're listening to it at home and hopefully partying to it, there's like a cohesive sound, and it's not necessarily based on the sample. Yes, we use samples as tools, but it's more basically about what we do with it.
And so then how has it been difficult for you to take your very quote unquote live sound and go into the studio with it? Because I imagine, you know, the really only effective way that you could capture what you do live is with a live album. So are you saying, okay, we're going to the studio and we're focusing on production and not really, you know, how we operate as a live band? Are they sort of two separate things?
Well, it has been pretty difficult. Like, that's what we actually are talking about right now is that transition, which I think any band that starts off as a kind of jamming live band, you face that, because there's just something that doesn't translate between something you might do live that goes off in a crowd and then you try to record it, and vice versa. Sometimes you start recording a song first and produce it and then you play it live, it hasn't worked. And we're still, I mean, right now that's kind of the challenge that we're facing right now with some of our new stuff, is how to create that balance of something that works not only live, but also produced. And then also when it's produced and it's produced with a certain amount of layers, then we now have to figure out a way to play it live with just the three instruments that we have. You know, we had our live remixing CD, which was live off the floor, which was fairly easy to do because it was just us playing with, you know, what we could at the time. But once you're in the studio, your mind goes, you know, you have unlimited tracks, you can do a certain amount of things. And then you take that song that you just finished that's so produced, and you realize, you try to play it live and you don't have enough hands. And, you know, that's the thing that we're trying to figure out now. It's a good challenge, and I'm confident that we are addressing it and we're getting to it. But I think you're definitely right. It's definitely something that every live band has to go through.
Yeah, like we have an EP of 7 songs coming out, and the majority of them probably started in the studio rather than started live. And some of them are in the show now, but some of them were puzzled on how to incorporate them into the show. And it was because it started so studio heavy. So it's like now we have this EP that we're all like, we like the music on it. But, you know, some of it's like, there's like a lot of tracks that we play live, and then there's some that we don't. So, you know, I think our goal is, you know, the next EP to just start everything from a live basis, like start everything in the rehearsal room, translate that into the studio, and then be able to play everything live and have it sort of translate into a production and a live setting, you know, because we want people to basically go on the internet, hear our music and like our music, whether they know we're doing it live or not, and then come to the show and discover that we're doing it live and be fucking shocked, you know, just be like, oh my God, like these guys do this 100% live, but we intrinsically just like their music. And we want people that come to our show already existingly that like us because we're this live, cool, crazy remix act to go and discover our music on the internet and like it because they like it. You know what I mean? So we're looking, that's kind of the balance that we're currently trying to strike, and we're definitely getting there. So we're very excited about that.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. Finally, Tune, are you going to revisit your rapping or singing career on this EP?
Well, I don't think so.
That's too bad. We're still looking forward to it, though. David Matisse, Flo, Tune, Keys and Crates, thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
Thanks, man.
Ring the Alarm from Keys and Crates' new one, the Blackout EP, slated for release in early November. That's going to do it for this week's UNS podcast. Special thanks go to Craig Hill with 2+2 Management, and of course my guests, Adam Tune, David Matisse, and Greg Dawson, a.k.a. Gregoire Flowinski. Keep up with Keys and Crates at theUNS.com because they are constantly touring, and you want to know when they're coming to your hometown. Remember, for the best in DJ gear and accessories, visit DJTechPro.com to check out the vast array of mixers, workstations, and toys for DJs of all stripes. That's DJTechPro.com. There are only 2 days left in the submission period of the annual UNS Challenge. Please visit theUNS.com/theUNSChallenge2 for all the information. If you produce electronic music, you don't want to miss out on this opportunity. You can win amazing gear from DJ Tech Pro, produce an EP at What Music in Fort Collins, and you'll have a chance to open for Lotus sometime in 2012. Win tickets to see Anasia, Scream, and Benga, Amon Tobin, and Sonic Blossom featuring Ott, Random Rab, Craddy, Janover, and more by visiting theUNS.com/contests. Please visit theUNS.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theUNS.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theUNS.com. Join the conversation at the UNS podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week with Crizzly.